I would say my mom has been a great inspiration because I look at her, you know, she never let the difficulties of life set her back.
From Value Invest Asia, this is The Asian Mavericks. We explore the hidden stories of successful founders, business leaders, and investors in Asia. Here's your host, Stanley Lim.
This week, we chat with the CEO of Cecil REIT, Ms. Cecilia Tan. Cecil REIT is listed on the Singapore Stock Exchange, and it's a REIT with a unique focus on outlet malls asset. It's currently managing 4 outlet properties in China, operated by its sponsor, Cecil Group. And Cecil Group is the largest outlet mall operator in China right now. So Cecilia grew up in Singapore, and her childhood experience really taught her the need to be independent and forging her own path in life. I was really touched by her story throughout, and I think that you're going to enjoy it as well. So let's get started.
Well, I'm a true blue Singaporean girl, I would say, you know, born and bred here, did my schooling here all the way to NUS. A small family, just myself and a younger brother. My parents were not really fully educated. The interesting thing about my family background is my parents, they operate a provision shop. You know, work and living is combined together, very much a part of how I grew up. In fact, because my father had chronic illness, so he was not able to work most of the time. So, you know, at 10 years old, I was roped in by my mother. I don't call it labor exploitation, but, you know, literally at 10 years old, I started working for her in the shop because clearly, I think, you know, she being a woman and then didn't have enough support and she didn't have enough financial resources to hire workers, because it's just a small provision shop family. So I actually grew up really in the shop. So my life was really school, shop.
Right.
Yeah, and I did that all the way till I sort of got married. So, you know, close to like 20 years. Yeah, so, but it formed a very deep part of, you know, who I am. Because working in the shop means I have to be very good with my time management, right? Because, I have limited time and my mom is really hardworking. She will open the shop at 7 a.m. and she will close at 10 p.m. So literally when I got up, I have to start to help her open the shop and then prepare to go to school. And then I don't really stay back in school. So that was some of the feedback or complaints from my school friends that they never see me around, but because I think a lot of people didn't know that I have this obligation, I had to go home and help my mom, and then I will work in the shop and then all the way until like she will close up at 10 p.m. So and then every day then I will spend about 1-2 hours to really do homework. So you know, that's been my life.
So which part of the duty around the provision shop do you normally handle?
Okay, so because I can understand English, right? So I will end up handling a lot of the admin stuff for my mom, because a lot of the letters from the government and even some of the vendors, they English, and then she has no idea what these are. So right. I took on a lot of that. Plus also I handle the money part lah. So in those days, not like now, got internet, right? So you basically got to collect a few days of, the takings from the shop. And then, you know, I have to literally then count the money every night. And then a few days later, I will bring those money to the bank. So every time I go to the bank, I will like be very, very looking around, making sure that nobody is following me.
Right, okay.
You know, so at a very young age, I had that kind of exposure about, you know, what it means to make a living.
Yep.
Literally. But I think because of this, I have grown up to have a very deep sense of responsibility, maybe because I'm the eldest child and, seeing how hard it is for my mom to handle the shop alone, I grew up with a deep sense of responsibility, and she became very, very reliant on me. Mm. And also through that whole period, as you can imagine, I have to balance my schoolwork and, you know, even I don't have much personal time. I've also grown to be much more resilient. And perhaps that has also given me a lot of grit to, really handle all sorts of unexpected situations. You know, when we manage a shop, right? I mean, just to give an idea, the shop is in an environment where there are a lot of low-income families. So my customers include people even like the prostitutes, the drug addicts, and a lot of blue collar workers. So from a very young age, I had a lot of deep exposure to a really a segment of the society, which I think quite represent really the true ordinary life of Singapore.
That definitely brought back memories also, because my mother for a short period of time was also opening a provision shop. And of course, even through that, having to balance work-life, work and study at a very young age, you managed to work your way to university as well. And also to NUS, nonetheless. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, your journey to NUS, and how do you end up choosing the degree that you wanted to do?
Yeah, as I mentioned earlier, my parents were not educated. So clearly, actually, even when I finished my PSLE, they were not able to help me. So a lot of things I started very young. I got to start to be very independent and got to be very self-motivated and be very clear. So I think to some extent that helped me to form that what I want from a very young age. So one of those things I do is I go by elimination first lah. I look at what I don't want. Okay, if you don't know what you want, I think the easiest is you do what you don't want. When I was choosing university, again, you know, I'm very practical. Because of my family needing me to be home every day, staying in hostel is not an option. So the one that got eliminated first is was NTU lah. Right, because it's just so far away. I cannot imagine traveling back and forth. And you know, I'll be so tired, right? And at that point in time, actually, you don't have a lot of university choices. It's basically NTU and NUS. So, you know, by default, I went to NUS. And because I did commerce, the natural path would be to go to business administration. It's actually a 3+1 year course. The plus one is the honors program. So in those days, right, it's not a direct honors. So, you know, it's based on your results and then you'll be offered to do the additional 1 year honours. So I actually was offered and I did the additional 1 year. So I actually graduated 1 year later than my classmates, yeah.
Along the way, you mentioned that due to your family background, you have to be more independent in your studies. We would always meet people who can sort of become like our mentor or our inspiration when growing up. Do you have such a figure during your school days?
To some extent, not really, but I would say my mom has been a great inspiration because I look at her, you know, she never let the difficulties of life set her back. And my mom was a very entrepreneurial. You know, the professional shop, she will be thinking about, okay, what are the high value items that she'll be selling? So every now and then, she will like shift things around and, you know, she will like she'll be selling new items. And at one point, I remember one part of the shop, she even rent out to somebody to sell those like refresh clothings, you know, those secondhand clothings. So I thought she was very entrepreneurial, and that definitely had got me thinking that I think we cannot just rely on the convention. We need to keep breaking out new ground. So I saw that even in my mom, who was not educated, she cannot speak English. She had very limited knowledge of Chinese. But I thought that, wow, the human mind is actually a lot stronger and a lot more resilient is really, you know, if you know what you want, you will be able to find a way to try to go there.
I can definitely sense that you have great respect for your mom and how much she influenced you.
Yeah.
Especially thinking about being resourcefulness.
Yes.
Looking at different things and different angle of the things. Let's go back to, you know, after you graduate, how do you end up in the, I guess, the investment industry, or what makes you come to the investment industry?
Yeah, it's interesting. My first job was with a local bank, which I shall not name. I got that because they did a career fair in NUS, and, you know, I thought, okay, we'll just sign the application, and, you know, lo and behold, and then they gave me a job and said, you know, so in those days, you're like clueless in terms of what you want, but you thought banking is a nice place to start with. Mm-hmm. But the funny thing, they posted me to a HR department.
Right.
Right. So I was in HR department for a few days and I reckoned that, no, I think this is not what I want. It was quite interesting to be HR department, but I told myself, if I'm in a bank, I really want to do hardcore banking. So I actually requested to a transfer, right? And so then they got me to see one of the top senior corporate lady, in the bank, and then I went to see her, and she said, okay, what do you want to do? I said, I want to do banking. But she said, all the corporate bank banking positions are all filled. No, so I said, well, if I don't do banking, then, you know, I think I will leave the bank. And then she was like totally shocked. What is this young girl talking about? You know, she just got herself into this bank. And then she's like, you know, I suppose you're just fearless, right? And then, you know, and she said, hang on, somebody has just resigned from the branch. Okay, so would you mind going to the branch? I said, yeah, why not?
Cecilia really struck me as a go-getter and someone who is fearless. For most of us, if we're starting our first job, maybe the tendency for us is just to do the job and keep our head down. But if we do that, we'll really end up wasting our whole life doing things that we might not even enjoy. Not Cecilia, and very early on, she knew that the job that she was assigned to was not what she wanted, and she fought for a better outcome for herself.
So I went to the branch. I stayed in the branch for about a year. So it was very interesting because at the branch, because I was a management trainee, they rotate me, right? So I got to be the cashier and I even got to count money in the vault. So after a year, I thought, okay, I had enough of fun with branch banking. But and then at that point in time, there's this UK merchant bank, very well known, Rothschild. And they advertise in the papers. And that, you know, those days we have to look at newspapers to apply for a job, not internet. Right, so they advertise and then they say corporate finance. So, you know, I was very innocent. I thought, oh, corporate finance sounds very interesting. Oh, maybe it's doing finance-related stuff, right? So I just, you know, innocently applied. And, you know, I was called for interview. And when I went to the interview and then I was told that they received something like 400 applications. I said, wow. Okay, so I said, okay, I'm very, very lucky. Right. So, and then I went through and then I was eventually selected to join Rothschild. So at that point in time, they called it corporate finance. But if you understand in today's term, it's actually also a form of what they call investment banking. So a lot of the work that I was doing then was really M&A advisory and also doing capital markets, although on a smaller scale because it's a merchant bank. They call it the merchant bank. But it was the beginning of a career that eventually I grew to love a lot. So I had exposure, what it means, like, you know, I was doing some very interesting transactions. I don't know, you're probably too young at that point. Yeo Hiap Seng take over.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. So I was involved in that transaction in a sense that we were advising Yeo Hiap Seng. They had, you know, it was a, in a long-term history in Singapore, they saw a competing offer.
Wow.
Wow, so it was really interesting. And I did some bond issuance for some electronics company. Some of these companies already got delisted along the way. So I had a glimpse of, wow, you know, the capital market space and, you know, how all this investment banking, that's how companies grow and that's how they raise money. And subsequent to that, and due to leadership changes, I left Rothschild and then I went to a private equity firm for about less than a year. Because when I joined the private equity firm, the global financial crisis hit. So things came to sort of a, you know, standstill. And then again, I think, you know, to your point, how I have a lot of guiren along my career. And some of my ex-colleague called me and said, you know, come and join this company called Jardine Fleming. I don't know whether you know, heard of them, but Jardine Fleming during the 90s, they are part of the Fleming's group, Jardine Medicine group, right? And they had this European investment banking outfit, which is also very well known. So I actually joined Jardine Fleming, and then that was really the beginning of really a very deep, was not too long, but, you know, very intense experience in investment banking. Again, you know, the extension of what I do on the M&A space, and I did a lot of IPOs, also helping very large corporations here in Singapore doing fundraise, like preferential shares, convertible bonds. So it was really very fun, but a lot of hard work, very long hours. But I love the adrenaline and the intensity. And every transaction is different. So that is what I really love about investment banking. And every client is different. And investment banking, at those days, you are trying to provide solutions to your client, whether they are in terms of the business expansion or their capital requirements. So I did that for about a 5 year because in between Jardine Fleming, you know, during those days, there were a lot of mergers amongst the large banks. So Jardine Fleming got acquired by Chase Manhattan. So, you know, from a European, I became a US bank. And shortly after, US Chase Manhattan merged with JP Morgan, right? So in a way, suddenly I became a bulge bracket investment banker. So that was sort of like a whole journey of 5 years. But towards the end, September 11, 2001, I remember very vividly, I was in Hong Kong on a work trip. I was in the hotel preparing to come back to Singapore the next day. I was shocked when I saw on the screen aeroplanes flying into World Trade Center. It was unbelievable. And I felt the whole world came to a crash. And I was on the phone, you know, figuring out how I'm going to get home because all the airlines were just panicking. And from there, the whole, I think that event changed really the whole world in very, very intense way and very fundamental way. And banking also went through a very deep patch of turbulence. There were literally blood on the street, so-called, because there was so much retrenchment because, you know, all the activities came to a halt because of September 11. And that got me thinking very deep about, you know, what is it I want in my career? Because while investment banking is very interesting, it's also feast and famine. You know, so you were always chasing deals, but you were just doing transactions. And after that, the client went on to carry out those transactions. And I always wonder what has happened to those transactions. Right. Did we give good advice? Did the client make good use of the platform or of that fundraise opportunity? So in 2002, I actually opted for voluntary retrenchment with JP Morgan. Because I came to a point I needed to rethink about sustainable long-term career. But at that point, it was also very interesting because I actually was the transaction team leader for Ascendas REIT.
Right. Okay.
So I think that was also a very critical point in my career, in what set the foundation for my path into a very longer term and deeper career in real estate. So I was in a way at the pioneer start of the REIT sector in Singapore. But of course, a lot of people, because I was a banker, right, that was never quite visible to a lot of people. But that experience has been really instrumental. In fact, I remember, you know, at the beginning stage when we were trying to do REIT, and a lot of people didn't understand what is a REIT. Is it a bond? Is it a stock? So, you know, we were on that path as bankers also trying to educate the general public about what is a REIT. And, you know, we will have to think about the storyboard and how we pitch a story. But of course, you know, now, fast forward, Ascendas REIT, of course, has done superbly well. And I was quite glad I have been part of that beginning of that mega REIT that it became today.
And going back to what you mentioned just now, after you voluntarily retired from JP Morgan, where did your career lead you to next?
Yeah, so I was taking a break in between, and in fact, and SARS came, right? So interestingly, again, one of my ex-colleagues called me. So I always end up with people calling me. So I think I take it as a good endorsement that people feel that, you know, I'm a good person, that they feel that I would be, you know, competent for that job. So I actually went on to do a career in real estate fund management and real estate private equity with a company called Pacific Star, which is probably no longer very much in the limelight. But in those days, Pacific Star, they were one of the, I would say, early pioneers in what we call the institutional fund management arena. I stayed with them for about 5 years. In between, did some very interesting transaction. I created their first income fund for them. And we had their German investors as cornerstone. And the first project we seeded for that fund is actually a project in China, Xingtianti.
Right.
So I remember because of that transaction, I went to China, I think in 2004, I was so completely wowed by Shanghai. Shanghai was at the time already very modern. The skyscrapers, they were a lot more forward-looking than what I saw in Singapore. So clearly, I think that gave me a glimpse of the potential of China real estate. And China at that point, you know, they were very much welcoming a lot of foreign capital and foreign direct investment. So we went on and did a deal in Xingtianti. It was fascinating project, Xingtianti. I mean, if you see the end product now, I saw the raw product.
Right.
When I went there, it was raw land. It was still very much under planning and part of it under construction. Mm. So it was a very fascinating transaction because Xingtian Si is a development project, but I have an income fund. So how do I reconcile? So this is again where, you know, this whole financial structure about how you package real estate to meet the financial returns, we actually did a convertible bond structure.
Right.
Okay, so a convertible bond structure has the elements that we price the coupon back to the cash flows of the underlying real estate, right? Mm. So that we can still meet the income requirement of the income fund. And we have an equity kicker because it was already agreed upfront. For any fund that invests, there must be an exit. Mm. So the exit will be won by reach of an IPO. And, you know, as history would have shown, indeed, that has happened. Mm. It was exited because at the time when we invested in Xingtian Deep, which was Sui On Land was still a private company. And a few years later, they went public. And, you know, we actually had that mechanism built in into the structure. And everybody exited with good profit. So, you know, that was truly a very successful transaction. And that was actually the first foray for me going deep into real estate in China. Although I actually traveled to China at the time when I was very young with Rothschild. Mm. So you'd be surprised, Rothschild at that time, they already looking at China market. I remember I went to Beijing in 93 or 94.
Wow.
And it was like just stunning because it looked so backward. So, you know, fast forward 10 years, I saw the dramatic change of China. And that really got me thinking about, wow, this country has a lot to offer. And of course, we knew, right? China eventually became the superpower and economic house that it is today. You know, it's not by sheer luck, but truly they have a lot of what you can offer in terms of market size and also the resources that they have.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. And just from this experience, you spotted, you know, the upward potential of real estate in China. Is it then and then that you realize that this will be your future career path that you want to focus on? This region and this industry?
Okay, not quite. I think my career actually is quite interesting. If you look at my career, I did a lot of different things because I'm the kind of person who cannot sit still and I don't like to do the same things over and over again. All right. So just to close the loop on, and in Pacific Star, I listed a second REIT in my career. I listed what is today called the Star Hill Global REIT. Mm. So a lot of people didn't realize, but if you trace back the prospectus, it's called Prime REIT, you will see my name in the prospectus.
Right.
As the chief investment officer. So because the assets, the original assets, Wisma Atria and Ngee Ann City, they were the assets under management by the fund house that I was working for.
Right.
And at that point in time, it was actually invested by the German investors. They needed an exit. And because, you know, at that point in time, REIT was actually coming up very nicely. We thought, okay, let's try to package this as a REIT. And truly, it was the right decision. It went on very successful. Even today, I don't think any REIT has broken the record. The retail tranche was 30 times subscribed, right? So I went on to do the second REIT. And of course, you know, because of my prior experience with Ascendance REIT, that gave me a lot of knowledge in trying to bring the REIT. But after I managed the REIT for about 2 years, I decided that, you know, I had sufficient experience. The headquarters called me back to manage a development fund. So, you know, you remember I had income fund and then I went on to do a development fund. So it's very interesting. So I see the real estate in different cycles. Mm. So when I went to sort of help manage the development fund as a portfolio manager, not as an investment person, so I actually switched to become the guardian or the gatekeeper, I actually look at sort of investment proposals more from the angle of the investors that is this a good deal? Does this meet the fund requirements? So I did that for a little while. But unfortunately, then, you know, Global Lehman Brothers crisis happened. Boom, you know. So, you know, you can imagine I went through so many of this ups and downs. But, you know, I think those things shape you and make you stronger. What doesn't break you, make you stronger. So eventually the development fund, you can imagine it was not fully deployed. And then again, one of my ex-colleagues called me up and said, you know, would you like to come and do something else totally different? I said, what? Somebody wanted you to become a CFO. I said, hang on, I am not accounting trained, I don't have an accounting degree. And they say that's precisely why they wanted to have somebody who you know, who is not the traditional CFO. So I went and I joined a company called KOP, and mm-hmm. today they're listed for about 4.5 years. So very interesting because you know, they were involved in many different types of businesses. They started as a high-end luxury developer, and then they went on to do hospitality mm-hmm. in Europe. So I was traveling to Barcelona. I was also looking after that business for them. So I had a lot of fun, right? doing something which is totally different, but it gave me a spectrum of what it means by managing a business.
Right.
Beyond just hard assets. Mm. Okay, how you manage a business is really, really managing, you know, I think a lot of that is managing the strategy, is managing really, do you have competent, qualified talents that will be able to help you with all the different domain knowledge, right? Because, you know, you cannot be all things to all people. Mm. So I did that for a period of time, and then I actually decided to take a career break because I think it was a little bit of a burnout situation for me.
Now, Cecilia has established herself in the market and make a reputation for herself. And opportunities are really coming to her. Here, it is easy for us to get lost in the work and just be chasing one deal after another. And what fascinated me here is Cecilia has a very particular way of making decisions on which opportunity for her to pursue. She likes to try things that have never been done before. Of course, some she succeeded, some she failed. But it has surely been exciting for her.
I thought I could rest for a long time. That didn't last very long. As usual, I think whenever I'm off the work, you know, my friend would say, you know, you're wasting your life or whatever. And then somebody came knocking to me. So I went on to try to, in 2014, I went on to try to list a REIT. I shall not say too much, but it was not successful for all sorts of reasons. But again, it was again, you may say it's a setback and failure. I actually take it quite positively. I always see this as an experience. Mm. What is it I can learn from this, right? And again, I think when I look back, that has helped me because it was trying to do something very different. Was trying to do a strata title REIT.
Right.
Okay. So it was again one of those like groundbreaking stuff, like nobody wants to do, but they found me and I'm saying, okay, I'm game for it. Mm. I never say I want to do the same old. So I tried that for 1 year, but it didn't take off. Mm. Well, I tried my best, right? And then I had a career break again. I went off to do my own things. And that's where in 2016, actually, I was introduced to my chairman, Vito Shi.
Right.
Yeah, so I actually knew him since 2016.
Share with us a little bit on the backstory. How do you met the chairman of Cecil Group?
Yeah, so I think at that point in time in 2016, I think he was invited to come to Singapore to explore a REIT listing for his outlets. And of course, and as part of that, right, he needed to sort of look out for professionals who could help him, take this platform to listing. So actually, interestingly, I was caught in town by a very well-established lawyer, by a well-established banker. They caught me both at the same time, telling me, because you're not doing anything, there's this client, do you know about outlet in China? I said, oh, is there an outlet industry in China? I was like, not even aware. I thought that was like, okay, let me go and find out, right? So interestingly, both of them recommended me to him. So I remember vividly, we met at Westin Hotel, at the beautiful lounge, and then he and his wife, of course, I was like really very pleased to see them, because and his wife was like so beautiful, is still beautiful, I would say. And I said, wow, this couple looks like, they are so polished from top to bottom. So we got along really well. So of course, at that point in time, there was discussions about me coming on to help him do the IPO. But unfortunately, at the time, I was already exploring another opportunity. Mm. So obviously, that didn't happen, and I went off, to do whatever that I decided that I wanted to do. But we kept in touch very much along the way.
Right.
And then what happened is that I left my job at the point in time in 2018, and then we got reconnected back again because we have always been in touch. And then he said, okay, what do you want to do now? So I said, again, I need to take a break because I need to, you know, sometimes 休息是为了走更长远的路 This is very true in my life. So I need to take those breaks and then say, okay. Then he said, you know, but I would like you to, you know, you know, come and help me along. So I asked him, you know, how can I help you? You know, but you know, I think he always enjoyed those conversations I had with him, how I would spar with him, I would like strategize with him. And I will share my knowledge about the REIT market, you know, because I've done like listed two REITs, right? And I always keep my eye on the REIT market. Mm. So I think he was, you know, he was always very eager to hear my opinion. And so in 2019, he said, why don't you work for me part-time? Mm. Because I think he sensed I was not prepared to go back on a full-time job, right? So I did that for 2 years with him. And in 2021, I think part of the Sessio REIT CEO succession planning, you know, that opportunity came up, and I thought, okay, maybe it's time I take the plunge, so to speak.
The final succession planning of taking over the CEO role in Sessio REIT, was that already in discussion right at the beginning, or is something that was brought up along
yeah.
the way?
Because in 2016, I didn't take on the opportunity, so I think he's always feeling that, you know, he would like to have an opportunity for me to come on board full time. Mm. So when I went to do the strategic advisory with him, I think we did speak about that, but not in a very big way until 2021. Mm. And then that topic came up again in a much more serious way. Then I thought, okay, I think they are really looking at succession planning. And I feel that that 2 years was actually very useful for me because, you know, they are not known here, and they are also very unknown to me back in 2016. But over the years, right, I've got to know Chairman personally, and I think him being the sponsor of the platform and really the key operator, it's very important that I have a like-mindedness and I see his strategy and this alignment. And in the 2 years when I was advisor, that gave me a lot of knowledge also about what he's doing in China, what's his vision for the REIT here. And I think I sort of got comfortable around those. Mm. And I felt, yes, I think that I would be more prepared to take on and be more ready to bring this forward.
On your, I guess, the first day of your work, how can you lay the ground for us? Like, how's business at that time?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
What do you see?
Okay, I think my chairman was somebody he's always thinking ahead. So he made the transition well. So, you know, I actually joined in July 2021, but I took office only August 2021. So there's a one month transition overlapping with the previous CEO. So that will help me sort of to get ready. So 2021 was very much still in COVID. The announcement of my appointment went out in May 2021. So I already started the planning in terms of when I get into this role, right, how what are the things I need to sort of like look at, improve at. And it would come down to really three components. One is looking at really the human resource, because, you know, this is a management office, a small office. You really need to make sure the caliber and, you know, the quality of the people up to what I believe they will be able to perform and deliver. That's one. Two, I look at where the REIT is. How is the REIT performing relative to the market, relative to the peers? So, you know, because when I was an advisor to chairman, I had a lot of understanding and I was looking at that. So that was a pretty easy part. The third is, of course, when I was a strategic advisor, but the relationship with sponsor is more remote. So when I came on, that relationship needs to close up. Okay. So, but the good thing is because when I was advisor, I got to know a lot of their senior people in the sponsor side. So that transition was a lot easier for me. So those were the three things I was sort of putting my focus on when I came on board in 2021. So on those three things, the easiest part was to deal with the REIT strategy. The first thing I started was refinancing. Okay, now because I had dealt with China markets before, you know, China markets, while it looks like they have a lot of opportunities, but it is a country with a lot of unexpected events, as history has shown. So the first thing I came on board in 2021 was to deal with the refinancing, but the debts won't mature until March 2023. Okay, now looking back, the strategy, that call was correct. So I make sure I look at what's the most important in terms of the survival and the life and death of the REIT. The other thing is, of course, as with anything, when there's a change of leadership, right, people may start to think about whether they want to stay on or not stay on. And over the course of that 1 year, I had a 50% staff turnover. Right, it looks very frightening, but actually I always think it's a blessing in disguise because it always gives me the opportunity to now try to level up. And I also restructured the team a little bit. And I think 1 year now, I've replaced the team. I feel the current team, at least from the strategy that I want to execute, they are a lot more competent. They are a lot more cohesive. So, and I feel a lot more confident with my team now under me to really deliver the long-term strategy for the REIT.
And why don't we talk a little bit more about Cessia REIT right now? And you talk about laying the groundwork for the future strategy of Cessia REIT, but what is the future strategy of Cessia REIT? Maybe you can go into detail a little bit.
Yeah, so I think we look back in terms of the investment mandate. You know, if you look at the investment mandate, it's actually really a global mandate because outlet industry is a global industry. But with an initial focus on China, naturally, because, you know, the sponsor, they have the natural advantages in China. And to put in context, China outlet industry is actually very young relative to, say, US or Japan. Outlet industry in China is only about 21 years, right? It's probably about the same age as the REIT market here in Singapore. But if you look at the US outlet industry, they started in the 70s, right? So, you know, definitely. And outlet, I think, to some extent, is always a very specialized retail format. So if you sort of look at the immediate strategy of Cessia REIT, and I can't really talk about, say, 10, 20 years, that's a bit too far out, but the immediate is we will continue to really solidify our outlet strategy in China. And, you know, I think our results so far have pointed out that this this industry is clearly very defensive. And as far as we're concerned, we will be looking to try to expand the footprint. How? The sponsor, they still have two very large outlets, one in Xi'an and one in Guiyang. Now, the question we ask that, why is it that Cessia REIT haven't listed for 5 years? We have not done anything. Now, I think we need to put it in perspective. In the 5 years now listing, about 3 years they were in COVID. So clearly, I think you're not going to be in the position to do any acquisition in COVID because, you know, those are times that you really need to just manage the underlying portfolio and in responding to the volatility in the marketplace. But of course, now we are in the post-pandemic environment. But again, this year, I think the environment for China and globally, we are still facing very strong headwinds, right? About high interest rates, high inflation, and China. The reopening effect are still yet to come through. But that actually, in a way, I feel then allow us more time to get more ready. Because doing the acquisition requires a lot of different components, particularly on the capital side of things. So we need to make sure we lay the ground. What does it mean? We need to open up more channels of fundraise. Beyond, because right now we're still relying a lot on bank borrowing. So, you know, me and my team, we are now looking at how are we going to open up different avenues of fundraise to make it, you know, we have more ability to raise fund quickly and also at, you know, a reasonable cost of capital. So I think in the immediate future, we feel China still has a lot to offer because of the young industry. And also the other thing is the sponsor is the number one outlet operator in China. Now, this is a very good advantage that I need to leverage off, right? And then the question is, okay, having done China, beyond that, where do we go? And this is something that we have been, will be sort of thinking through a lot more because I think the REIT space has also shown, you know, concentration risk is something that we need to pay attention to with a single asset class, single country exposure. When times are good, you know, those work well. But when stress times, as you can see recently, a lot of the REITs that had very bad performance suffered from a single concentration risk effect. So I think that's food for thought for me as a CEO in terms of how I am going to try to bring the REIT to a different level that will continue to have more resilience, but yet not diminishing the natural advantage of the China outlet industry?
Yeah, I have so much question on what you just said just now. But maybe just start from the most basic, right? We've seen that a lot of commercial spaces and retail spaces is facing a lot of headwinds from e-commerce. The model of outlet malls, of course, like you said, in China, is still very young and still growing very fast. Yeah. But can you share a little bit on that model in particular? Why, in a way, you are not too afraid of e-commerce, the trade of e-commerce, or you feel that it has the ability to withstand the threat of e-commerce?
Yeah, I think e-commerce is probably most understood in layman terms called online shopping, right? So I think the e-commerce really came to the forefront, of course, during COVID, because, you know, all the physical retail shops are not available for people to shop. And during that time, of course, those people who never did e-commerce or online shopping, went on. And, I think if you look back, what does e-commerce offer? E-commerce or online shopping offers convenience, right? It offers convenience and it also offers variety because, depending on the platform, I mean, some of the platform like Shopee, you can get a whole barrage of stuff. And then, of course, they offer you different options and price points. But why is it that we do not believe that e-commerce, in this case, online shopping, is going to be a threat to the outlet industry? Now, give you some statistics that it, in fact, during the COVID, right, the outlet industry actually grew a bit faster. Okay, so even during COVID, our own sponsor, between 2020 to 2022, they opened 5 outlets. So despite the fact that online shopping was like the thing that most people do, they still continue to open outlets. What does it tell you? Okay, they for outlet industry, the brick and mortar will still be the preferred. Okay, and I tell you why. Because one big component is missing: customer service. You can't get that in online shopping. Okay, and interestingly, I was also looking at an article that published by Forbes. Somebody was saying the demise of e-commerce. So after post-pandemic, previously there was prediction of demise of retail, but that never happened. So you can see that, at the end of the day, online shopping is not a binary outcome. It's not as though, if I have online, I cannot have physical. But you can see that retail has actually evolved that for those really savvy retail operators, they will embrace technology as part of their whole strategy. But of course, online shopping has disrupted the most the general big departmental store format. Like, in Singapore, case in point is Robinson, right? I think when Robinson decided to close shop, everybody was so shocked. But it tells you, because those big retail format, they have no clear value proposition. So they can't fight like the online space where they give you the clear value proposition of convenience and price competitiveness. In a big departmental store, it's like just like the online shop but offline, so you can't compete. But you can see that what has happened to Robinson, they have pivoted to become completely online. So, okay, so now outlets, I think we have a very different value proposition. Number one, we have a clear price point proposition. We provide discounts. Now, there is even if you go and do online, not every day you can get discount. But you come to outlet, every day you can get discount. And if we run promotional activities, you get even better discount. So that's number one. Two, interestingly, going back to this Forbes article, right? When they look at also the e-commerce, how it's the same we saw even during 2022 in China, a lot of e-commerce sites collapsed or closed off. Okay, part of that, I think, is also too much competition. But part of that is also, I think, people also get tired of e-commerce at some point in time. So I think there were also some similar effects in the US. And this article I quote, e-commerce sales across product categories were impacted very differently by the pandemic. And some categories such as apparel did have artificially high e-commerce sales, which diminished as customers felt more comfortable returning to stores. But other categories such as grocery experienced a permanent increase in e-commerce share of sales. So what does it tell you? the commoditized product. Things that you don't have to like try, things that you don't have to taste, or things that you don't have to experience, touch, grocery. Yeah. Right? So things are big departmental store, which is why they can't fight the giants of the online shopping. But outlet is very different for us. Outlet, for our outlet, if you look at some of the videos we post, we actually offer beyond just traditional outlet shopping, at least the ones that we are managing in China. We actually have a lot of lifestyle components and experiential. And you can't get that on online shopping. For example, in the Hefei one, we have a day zoo. You can't bring the zoo online, right? And then in Hefei, we have the biggest cinema in the area, okay? And then we have a lot of F&B. So F&B, you can't replicate online. So there are still things if the on the retailer operator front, if they know how to package the whole thing, you know, they're going to bring back the customers. And so we did. So post-pandemic, you see, we have, even for our first quarter sales, it was record high. We actually exceeded Q-on-Q 2019. And in first half, right, cumulative of second quarter, which second quarter is a softer quarter, partly because of China economic environment and also because of, second quarter, we don't have the festival element like the Chinese New Year. Still, combined basis, our first half for this year, year on year, is 20.5% higher at 2.3 billion. So what does it tell you? Online shopping is still there, but we have still broken new high record. So I think there's still this part about human being social beings. We like to go, right? And the feel-good factor, you can't get it online.
Yep. That I definitely agree. And yeah. We definitely see the revival of some retail malls all around the world. And that's good to know that your outlet malls are also bucking the trend of e-commerce and still coming out strong year on year. Another point that I wanted to bring up, and this is a concern some of my members has brought up to me as well, especially from the news of the real estate giant Evergrande bankruptcy cases, right? And that spooked a lot of investors, especially on real estate market on China.
Yep.
Although now it's still mainly on the residential market, but
yes.
They are worried, will there be a spillover effect to Cecil Reed? And maybe you can share a light to us. How's the market right now over there? And what are some of the risks that you're seeing, some of the opportunity you're seeing right now?
Yeah. If you sort of go back in time a little bit, that whole property crackdown happened in 2021. In fact, I just heard the news today. Evergrande, after 1.5 years, trying to go for a... try to be listed back again on Hong Kong. So you can imagine. So I think... And we started the refinancing right when the whole property crackdown started. So I think it evolved throughout the whole process. So the first thing that we face through the journey is that the whole, all the lenders became super, super cautious. And in fact, their appetite for real estate lending was so constrained. So you can imagine when we were going through the refinancing journey, it was very turbulent for us. Okay, but good things that we managed to finish that. Okay, and then the spillover effect on the ground, I think for a lot of these Chinese people is that, a lot of these property companies, right, they have a whole string of business partners. So when they have cash flows, they can't pay their business partners, the vendors cannot pay, that means some of these people may have to fold up their business, their employees also maybe have to retrench and people lost their jobs or, So if you think about it, the whole ground effect is that people become very, feel very uncertain about the economic prospects of China. And they will start to curtail their spending. In fact, I just went to China in June. Okay, when I went there, I saw a few things with myself. First, I think life is back to normal. So, nobody really wear masks. So people accept that, this post-pandemic, so they're very happy they don't have to wear masks. But you can see generally the mood is one of quite cautious. A lot of people talk about, them deferring big-ticket item spending. Okay, a lot of them talk about, try to save more. Because to prepare for, you know, rainy days, or, you know, in case anybody in the family lost a job. But interestingly, we're actually doing very good business. Why? Because it is in times like this, right? And people start to think about, how do I stretch my spending dollar?
Mm.
Okay. So we actually see outlet fulfilling that demand with ordinary people who are looking for, okay, last time I want to spend $100 on this full price item, but now I want to spend this $100 on two discounted items.
Mm.
Okay. So we are seeing actually new customers coming to our outlets. So yes, I think there's some pain in the system, but by the same token, I think the Chinese is not the first time they face economic hardship.
Mm.
Okay. I always feel they have a lot of resilience, and they are actually, the Chinese are one of the most savvy consumers in the world, right? So they will know how to perhaps re-manage their, or reorganize their spending structure and still maintain a reasonable level of living. And so this is what I'm seeing now in China. But no doubt, what we call the 消费降级 is indeed happening in China. So for us, we feel that we also want to respond to the where the consumers are now, that, you know, we give them the opportunity to hopefully maintain still their desire of wearing branded or carrying branded stuff without breaking the bank.
Mm.
Yeah.
I see. And another concern, I guess, because this has a larger implication across different real estate company as well, and your sponsors as your group, because a lot of investors here in Singapore might not be familiar with them.
Yes.
In a way, how can they reassure, you know, their sponsor financial strength is strong enough to...
Okay,
to
I think it's important we understand what is the core business of the sponsor. The sponsor only does one line of business. They are just an outlet operator. Okay, they are never a developer, period. So don't even talk about residential development. Not any sort of development they don't do. Now, they started development only on their own outlets at the beginning, because of course, they have to start the business somewhere.
Mm.
So at the beginning, in the mid 2008, they opened the first outlet. So they actually used their own balance sheet and developed 6 outlets.
Mm.
And 4 already they injected into the REIT. And 2, which is 2 are Xi'an and Guiyang. Mm. And after that, right, the sponsors stopped development altogether.
Right.
Okay, why? Because development is not their core business. They did development because they needed to get their outlet business off the ground.
Mm.
And once they have that track record ready, they have built a brand name in China. They went on to do what we call the asset-like strategy, 轻资产.
Mm.
Okay, 轻资产 means the assets are off balance sheet.
Right.
Okay, so basically, to put it very simple terms, it's actually a management operator stroke management contract.
Right.
In a nutshell, what they have done now, they have now 16 outlets under their management.
Mm.
Okay. Of the 16, 6 were developed by them.
Mm.
So the remaining 10 don't belong to them. They are not the owner, but they're just an operator. So what has happened is that if they have been approached by property owner, or they also approach some property owner in locations where they feel has good potential for outlet, but, you know, they are not represented.
Mm.
So they actually took on a few business models. They have also done JV with the existing owner, right? And then they went in and wrapped that as a CSE outlet.
Mm.
Okay. They have also done like a pure, like a master lease structure. They will take a 20 years master lease from the owner, did some capex, reject the whole structure and make it CSE outlet.
Mm.
So you can imagine very little capital is involved and the payback is a lot faster. Okay. So I think it's good that I have this opportunity to really diminish any concerns that, you know, the sponsor is in the developer space. Because, yeah, a lot of Chinese companies, because property development is such an easy way to make money.
Mm.
It's very tempting for a lot of corporates in China. If they have done well, you know, then they will dabble into property development. So I must say that to the credit of my chairman, he stayed very focused. Because I remember he told me, don't do things that you're not familiar with.
Mm.
Okay, so he is very focused and clearly show that he has this deep passion and deep knowledge, and he wants to continue to entrench his number one position in China and not dilute their effort by going in and get distracted into something else that he's not. Number two, because Cecil Group, the sponsor, they are not listed, so obviously they are not as transparent as other sponsors. But I would like to give your audience a glimpse of their financial strength. Now, if you see the refinancing, actually there's one part where we took a loan, a bridging loan of 308 RMB from the sponsor. Now, in today's time, the sponsor still has money to lend to me, the REIT. I think this is very powerful. Because don't you think that the sponsor will be thinking about, you know, I got to save myself first and not the REIT?
Yep.
No, but I think there are a few things here. One is there's true alignment of interest because the sponsor still has 57% stake in the REIT. Mm. So if the REIT is not doing well, the sponsor is not going to get any benefit out of it. Mm. Two, I think it's also demonstrate the sponsor is clearly from the cash flow standpoint because of the business strategy, they have been very prudent. Mm. You know, also, you know, in terms of the risk management, they have been very careful. Even though from 2020 to 2022, they opened 5 outlets, actually they scaled back, you know.
Wow.
Actually, they wanted to open more, but they scaled back and they deferred the opening of some outlets. So it tells you about a group who is very cognizant about the risk that they're operating in China, and they know how to manage the risk by, you know, pacing themselves and not just because I need to be in front of my competitor, I would do everything at all costs. Mm. Everything must come with a cost. So I hope that will allay some of the concerns for your members.
Right. Yeah, that's definitely a great explanation, and now giving us a deeper understanding on how the REIT and the sponsor actually operate, and giving us more peace of mind on the entire structure, how safe it is. Now maybe we can turn back, all right? Going back to yourself.
Sure.
It has been, by listening, you know, to your story, it has been quite an amazing journey for you. Mm-hmm. And I guess a very exciting life journey as well. It struck me, a lot of it, you know, we tend to feel that we doesn't want hardship in our life. But listening to your story, because of your childhood upbringing and what it forces you to learn at a very young age, and it really enable you to thrive when you start your career. And some of the things that stuck out to me is maybe during your time in your provision shop, you learn people skill that were not taught in school.
Yes. Managing difficult customers as well.
And how well you're able to build connection along the way in your journey. And but maybe you can spend some time to share a little bit, you know, now as the CEO, how's your management style like? How do you think about managing a team and motivating a team?
I thought I should ask the question of my team. No, but okay. I think capital management is very important, and also increasingly it's getting very, very difficult to really retain and attract talent, right? The way I feel about capital management and managing people is, I think given my own career, I like to be able to give each and every one of my colleagues some level of visibility in terms of their career path. Okay. And I'm a big believer of development. Development as a person, development professionally. Okay. I think when we perform in a job, it's not just the technical skill set, you know, but it's also the whole mindset about, you know, the growth mindset, the problem solving mindset, your grit. When you're faced with something that you feel, wow, this is too tough for me, do you give up? Or do you think about, okay, how do I leverage, okay, my resources internally? So that's something, you know, my colleagues will tell you, I believe a lot in empowerment. Okay, I don't believe in spoon feeding, because spoon feeding, you only spoon feed, like really is something so technical that you really need to, like, you know, do the drawing and then step by step. But I do believe that, you know, because there are a bunch of professionals, they have a certain level of quality. I always believe that they need to go and find the solutions themselves. No other teacher is best when you find the solution yourself. But my role is to coach you, guide you, and inspire you. Okay. Yeah. So hopefully I've done that here with my colleagues. Because I think that then they will find that they come to office. Otherwise, it's like, do the same old thing again. And then what am I here for? You know, am I doing this piece of work again? So even like very mundane stuff, routine stuff, I always challenge them. Right. So I'm quite a difficult CEO in the sense that I keep challenging them. But I think this has to be the case because, yes. You know, we spend so much of our life working. Mm. And then if you feel that at the end of your 30-year career, you look back, have I grown a person? No. Have I grown professionally? No. I think something is really wrong there.
Yeah.
You've not done justice to yourself, right? So, and I like to have that a lot of intellectual sparring with my team. You know, really, I would look at things differently and then they're like, wow, I never see that. You know, not that I'm more clever, but I think because of my experience, I've been there, done that a lot more. I hope I can give them more handles and guide them. Okay, maybe this is how you can look at it. And I think I'm still very young at heart. I'm always breaking new grounds, even for myself, right? So, you know, I had a lot of fun with my team doing investor relations. Since I came on board, one of those things, I believe the marketplace has taken notice that we have become very active on LinkedIn because it's such an easy platform, but you know, how do you milk the content? I just realized that now Cesare platform has more LinkedIn followers than me. When I first started, I have a lot more followers than the I think this is fantastic. It shows that we are doing something right. Okay. And then we talk about how we communicate. We communicate with intent. We communicate with insightful content. So every day I'm asking my team, you know, give me something, you know, so I can go and talk to the market. Because otherwise today I'm talking to you, the same old story is so boring. Okay. So there are different departments and every department I will request that they think out of the box. Yeah.
That's very good advice, I guess, not just for your staff, but for myself as well. And one question I really always like to ask my guests is, you know, you have achieved so much in your career, but right now, especially in today's time, the definition of success is a little bit different from when we were young. So to you right now, you know, at this stage of your life, what is the meaning of success to you? And do you feel you have already achieved that?
Okay, I actually feel uncomfortable using the word success because it connotes quite a fabric of arrogance. Yeah. I would like to say that I look at every journey, I look at milestone that I've achieved. Yeah. Even now, sitting here as a CEO, you know, every day I come to office, I ask myself, what else can I do better? When I look back, I think I'm glad that I've done some very interesting transactions, you know, when I was a banker. And I've also managed to overcome a lot of challenges. But sometimes also I've failed situations, like, you know, some of the REIT I wanted to go and list, it didn't happen. But all of this is okay. Because, you know, life is not static. And success is not defined by, you know, do you get an A or B? I think we look at the effort as well. So to me, making the effort is very important. Have I done my best? Have I considered things differently? And have I learned a lesson if I didn't achieve what I achieved? So, you know, so I never quite think of success in a way. I think when you have that in your mind, it will keep you because you think that you've reached there. But where is my final destination? I'm still searching for it.
If you can do it all over again, right? Today, you met yourself again when you first graduated and choosing to go into the working industry. How would you advise your younger self today?
Yeah. Actually, you know, I had the opportunity to join the public service. I was interviewed. Okay. I actually rejected that. So I think that to me was the right decision. Because if I didn't have my whole career in the private sector, I wouldn't have gone through so much different experience. If you ask me to choose, I would still say I would still do the same. Yeah, because I think every part of that journey, when I look back, it brings joy to my heart because I see myself level up. So every situation I go, I see myself level up. You know, so like when I was much younger, I didn't like to manage people. Okay, I try to do things on my own. Because of the way I was brought up, I was very independent. I didn't like to manage people. So I still remember one day, one of my managers and he came and said, you know, at this rate you're going, if you keep rejecting managing people, you're not going to go very far. And he said, you are actually a natural leader. He told me that. Mm. And I was like, no, I'm not. You know, so, but his words, right, got me thinking. And I have to then try to open up myself a bit more, because it's actually, you make yourself very vulnerable when you start to manage people. The good side, the bad side, and the ugly side will all come out. Okay. But when I decided that I will open up myself to start managing people, I get so much joy and fun doing that. Because part of that, I also discover about myself. The good, the bad, and ugly. Right? So when I look back, I think that whole journey on how, you know, one would come from, say, a junior role to a senior role. The thing I think is I acquired new skills along the way. I get to know myself better, and I become a more confident person.
That's great. Thank you so much, Cecilia. This is such a wonderful talk for me, and I learned so much from you. What I gotten from you is that life is a journey regardless of ups and downs.
Yes.
And, you know, you just enjoy the journey.
Yes.
And continue to level up yourself along the way. Right. Thank you so much,
absolutely.
Cecilia.
Hope we Thank can you, chat Stanley, again. For the opportunity. Thank you.
So there you have it. You have been listening to Cecilia Tan, the CEO of Cecilia REIT. Cecilia now looks set to bring Cecilia REIT to a future beyond just managing property for its sponsor. Her team are also embracing the new media, showcasing the REIT more and more to potential investors and their potential talent. You can follow them on LinkedIn.
I'm Stanley, and you have been listening to The Asian Mavericks, produced by Value Invest Asia. If you like this show, please give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. And of course, if you know of the perfect candidate for us to interview for our next episode, you can always reach out to us through our social media. Thank you. Until we meet again, stay safe.